Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bob Thune, and I'm actually here with a special guest and friend, Trevin Wax. Trevin, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
I'm without Pastor Dusty, Pastor Chris, Bethany, who are often with us on this podcast, so it's just me today. Had Trevin in town to do some work for the Gospel Coalition chapter here in Nebraska, and I thought, man, as long as you're in town, I'm going to get you in the podcast studio and have you sit down, and we're going to have some conversation about all kinds of topics that you think a lot about. But actually, I just wanted to start with, acknowledging the stacks that we have here. So let me start there, because that's what we always do on this podcast. So thank you to Kelsey Bear, listener Kelsey, who once again has made amazing, delicious cookies, and once again made so many of them that I was able to feed the entire Corndale staff team this afternoon. And Trevin and I just enjoyed one as we sat down to record this podcast. So props to Kelsey. And thank you for contributing so nicely to this Wednesday Conversation episode. So Trevin, I assume a lot of listeners will be familiar with you. You're an author, you're a speaker, you're fairly well known within evangelical circles. But for folks who just haven't read your stuff or don't know you as well, I'd love for you to just start by talking a little bit about your backstory. How did you get to where you are in life? What were sort of where'd you start in life? Where'd you grow up? How'd you come to faith? Those kinds of things.
Yeah, I grew up in Middle Tennessee, and was born into a really fervent Christian home. Both sets of grandparents, believers. My parents, believers. My parents were doing a question and answer catechism with me before I learned how to read. I was like
amazing.
3 years old. In fact, they tell me my first day of kindergarten, I came back and slammed my little panda book bag on the couch, all mad. And they were like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, "Well, I went to school and I still don't know how to read." You know? So apparently I was
I've been a learner from an early age,
a nerd. Yeah, for sure. My mom used to have to get on to me because I would, you know, I would like as a kid, I don't know why, I was like in first or second grade, was determined I was going to memorize the book of Exodus. And so like my mom would come in like to my room and I'd be like in the closet under with the light on, but with all the like clothes hanging up, you couldn't really, you know, see really well. And I was like trying to memorize Exodus. Like, I think I got through Exodus 1. I still remember parts of Exodus 1 because I was like 6 wanting to memorize the book of Exodus. I just love the Moses story. It was just, what you got to, I mean, if you're 6 years old.
Yeah, it's an amazing
Moses
story.
Moses is amazing. Yeah. So I grew up in a really, really like devout Christian home. It was independent Baptist, which is a little different than Southern Baptist or some other groups. But my parents were really involved. My grandparents had been very involved in the sort of independent Baptist movement at the time. My grandfather was the printer for a newspaper called The Sword of the Lord.
Awesome title.
Yeah. It had been located in Wheaton, and then they relocated to Tennessee. And that's actually what brought my dad's family to Tennessee. And that's how my mom and dad met. But I went to a Christian school. The one thing I'll say, like, there's a lot I could say about independent Baptist life and culture, but the one thing that you don't, that came across really clearly for me as a young kid in the 1980s in an independent Baptist school and church is that the Bible is true and the stakes are eternal. Like you had from revivalist speakers to just normal preaching, it was, what we're talking about here is serious and it's life or death. Yeah, heaven or hell. Like it was, and so that really impresses on you at an early age of the importance of this. So, I mean, I was really young when I decided I wanted to follow Jesus and, you know, prayed to receive Christ. My parents wisely held me back a little bit for a few years before I was baptized, just to kind of, you know, watch that. But I wound up, my parents moved to a Southern Baptist church plant, which in the independent Baptist world is kind of like,
you're selling out,
kind of like converting to Catholicism or something. It's like a big deal. And that happened when I was in fourth grade. And so what was really interesting is I basically was straddling two worlds. It was more of a fundamentalist world. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean that in the sense that I once had a conversation with John Piper, and John Piper was like, the difference between an evangelical and a fundamentalist is the evangelical is holding the Bible up, and the fundamentalist has one hand under the Bible and a fist on the top of it. You know? And so it's a lot of posture, not actually, yeah. You know, doctrinal differences, but I kind of straddled both worlds, more of a broadly evangelical world growing up in my youth group and in my church. And I had an expository Christ-centered preacher that was very influential, just listening to him exposit the text week to week. And then a more of a fundamentalist school. And I also had a heart for missions, and that came from both sides. I mean, both sides were so big on mission, and started going to Romania as a teenager on short-term mission trips, just a few years after.
You know, I was going to say this pretty soon after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The dictator, Nicolae Ceaușescu, and his wife were, there was a revolution, and they were executed on Christmas Day.
I do remember that.
In 1989. Yep. And so my first trip there would have been in 1997. So several years, I mean, but like where we're touring the sites and people are telling us, hey, this is what I did when the tanks were over here. And then when they were shooting over there, and like, I mean, it was really, really, engaging. But, I went back every year with my church on short-term trips. We did evangelism. We did, you know, ministry in the village. We did dental work, worked with orphans. We did, you know, general health stuff, fitted people for eyeglasses. I mean, it was a broad spectrum of meeting both spiritual and physical needs. And that was so formative for me at a young age to sort of already see the world from a different side. And I took a gap year after high school. And it was in that year that the Lord redirected me to move to Romania. So I was 19. I bought a one-way ticket. And
wow.
I moved to Romania and was there for 5 years and learned the language, learned the culture, learned how to preach in Romanian, teach in Romanian, did had a radio ministry there, did all my essays and everything at like a Christian university there, met my wife. She's Romanian. We met there. We got married in Romania a couple years in, had our first son while we were living over there. So kind of, you know, had the beginnings of our marriage and life with kids was started over there. So that was a hugely formative 5 years for me, the cross-cultural missions experience.
What caused you to move back here, or how did that shift happen?
It was really the last year I was there. I knew I wanted to keep learning. I mean, and you know, this goes back to when I was a kid. I'd known since I was six, I wanted to write. So that was like, I knew I was gonna write. Whether anyone ever read anything I wrote is another question. But I also just love studying. I mean, the cool thing about that, the Christian university that I was at, is that it has one of the better libraries in Eastern Europe. I mean, it like so many donated books, and most of them in English. Wow. So I just had like in between classes, you couldn't check out books because they were so valuable. You couldn't check them out. In between classes, you know, like, I'd have an hour or two to kill. I mean, I was just in the library reading whatever. I mean, everything from like the quest for the historical Jesus, the parables of Jesus I was fascinated by, different views on Paul at the time. They had this huge section of just Christian history magazines where I was like immersing myself in Christian history. So I really felt like my mind come alive, not just in the classes, but in the library there. And I just knew I wanted to keep learning. So at that point, it was like, well, are we going to, you know, go somewhere else in Europe to learn? Or am I going to go, you know, do the American MDiv kind of a thing? I already felt like, you know, a call to pastoral, some kind of ministry. And so that was the decision. So it was actually way harder moving with my wife and our 1-year-old son to the States than it was for me as a 19-year-old to move to Romania. Where at that point we're saying goodbye to family of hers and mine. You know, we packed everything we had into 4 big suitcases and had to kind of start over, you know, bought furniture at yard sales and moved off, you know, off the campus of Southern Seminary, which is where, I went. And we were in Kentucky for about 18 months. And then I took an associate pastor role at a church in Tennessee for about almost 4 years. After that, we had our daughter while we were living there. And it was just a great season of ministry, but it was kind of like I had gotten a European education very influenced by British evangelical, you know, culture. And then I got the sort of an American master's education. And then, yeah, so, I mean, that was very formative though, to be out of your own culture for that long and then to come back, you know, you start to, you see things differently, I think, over time.
Talk about, yeah, so you've been in the pastorate. I think now you're working with NAMB, right? North American Mission Board.
Right.
I think you did a stint in there with Lifeway at some point. Is that right?
So, yeah, 11 years.
Yeah, talk about sort of the vocational journey you've been on since seminary.
Yeah, so so it was an associate pastor, was already writing. So I basically, it's hard to tell the story without mentioning blogging because you remember
Thank
the old
you.
Blogging.
Blogging, that was important season of,
it
of
was.
The internet.
Yeah, so, you know, like a lot of people, when they think about blogging in the Christian world, you got to mention Tim Challies.
Yep.
The blog father.
Yep.
That we call him.
The blog father. Justin Taylor.
Justin Taylor. Yeah. There was a guy named Steve McCoy.
Yep. Steve
who
McCoy.
Was a Southern Baptist guy. So there were these guys. They're all older than me, but I was like, man, I love the discipline of like writing.
The internet monk. Did you get into him?
Oh yeah. I knew Michael Spencer. Yeah. I got to talk with Michael Spencer multiple times. It was really cool because before social media, like people don't, this was a weird season where people found each other through blogs.
Yeah.
And like linking from either the blog role on the side where you like link to other people's blogs or from links, you know, you're like commenting on each other's posts and like you could have conversations that went beyond just like angry tweets.
Right.
You know,
or thumbs up.
Yeah. Or thumbs up or Facebook, you know, rants and things like that. It tended to be, it was democratized.
Yes.
But the interesting, intriguing, helpful content tended to rise to the top.
Yeah, it did.
And so, and this is before social media at all.
I was going to say it's an era before the smartphone and really before social media or before the uptake of social media. So you kind of had this sweet spot where it was you had to be on a laptop or on a computer, but it was distributed.
Right. And so I started, I had a go at blogging at the end of my stint in Romania and a little bit after I'd gone to seminary. But then I kind of let that go. And then I actually started the blog called Kingdom People in October of 2007. And I was like, I'm going to blog every day. I'm going to do something, even if I just release a prayer or a quote from a book or something. But I'm going to try to like have an article or two every week. I'm going to do a book review. I'm going to interview people of books that I liked. And it was kind of, you could really be eclectic back then too. You could just kind of do whatever, you know, if it was a funny
your
video,
blog, you whatever found, you care
put it
about.
On, yeah. It's kind of like, it was like a slower social media back then. And anyway, my first year blogging, I scored an interview with N.T. Wright up in Asbury, right when the New Perspective on Paul stuff was happening. And so, I got to record that and then I basically transcribed it. And then, so I'm doing all this like blogging and I'm like interacting with like authors because I was amazed. I would like write, you know, Craig Blomberg, who has, I'm reading his New Testament study stuff and like asking him if he'll do a blog interview. And he's like, well, sure. And so it's like, wow, everyone says yes. Cause like blogs were a way to like get your, you know, message out. So it was great because I'm making all these connections. I'm meeting other like-minded people. I'm sort of like finding my way into the sort of gospel-centered movement at the time without really knowing that that's where I was, you know, headed. I just, because the emerging church thing was happening at the same time, which that's a whole other conversation. But there were questions being asked by emerging church authors that were really good missional questions.
Yes, they were.
And so I'm cutting my teeth as a 25-year-old, you know, associate pastor, trying to answer those questions well and trying to think outside the box. At the same time, I'm being formed by, you know, I'm discovering Tim Keller around this time, John Piper around that time, and others. So it's a really fascinating moment. Like we could talk about that era. It was a very weird era. I mean, Rob Bell's book, Velvet Elvis, has a footnote that says that his readers should all go and read everything John Piper's ever written.
Yeah.
I mean, that's weird.
Yeah.
Because when you think about Rob's trajectory and then you think about John's ministry, it's just, there's a lot of weirdness in that season.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I don't know. What would you date the emerging church? Was that about 2000 to 2010? Was that kind of the window?
Nah, I'd probably say, I think it was almost done by 2010.
Okay.
I would probably date it more 98 to 2008.
Okay.
But it was waning by the problem with emerging churches is that it basically just became indistinguishable from left-wing progressive Christianity.
Right.
That was the problem.
But in that season, that decade of 98 to 2008, all those conversations were happening kind of in the same space. Yes. Like you had John Piper engaging with Rob Bell, and you had
Dan Kimball.
Yeah. You had all these. It was sort of a very live present, and it happened in blogs, but it happened also at conferences. It was the cool thing about it was it didn't feel tribalized. It felt like, hey, we want to press these questions. Can we get together and have a conversation about it? The conversation might be wildly divergent, but it was had.
Right. No. And it was a conversation where those lines, a lot of them were doctrinal and political, eventually became clear.
Yeah.
But the reason I had to talk about the blog, is just because that's really where I cut my teeth on writing regularly. And as the blog got more traction, it was also that season where traditional publishers are looking outside the box to see who they're going to publish. So, you know, I had wanted to publish for a long time because I've been writing for so long, but Crossway reached out, and that was my first book came out with Crossway. And then my second,
which was it?
Holy Subversion.
Okay.
My second was Counterfeit Gospels, which came out with Moody a year later and launched with the Gospel Coalition in 2011 at that conference. It was kind of the launch. It wasn't a Gospel Coalition book, but, my agent laughs about this, 'cause I basically said back when we first met back in, 2010, I want to write a book a year for the next 40 years. And I'm on track to basically publish something, you know, like, not necessarily going to be like a book, but, the publishing part of my sort of ministry, I think of myself as a writer first. And then all of the other leadership opportunities I've been given have kind of been in the overflow of that. And Lifeway was one of those. So Ed Stetzer reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in helping start a curriculum that would be theologically robust, gospel-centered, and mission-driven. And we went back and forth on that, talked about that, and then eventually the answer was yes, I'd love to help start that. So I went to Lifeway in 2010, and in 2012 we launched the Gospel Project, which was a curriculum. It is a curriculum for adults, students, and kids. The kids version of that in particular exploded beyond any of our estimation. So the Lord just really blessed that whole ministry effort. I mean, at one point, I don't know what the numbers are now because I don't work at Lifeway now, but I think at one point it was about 1.7 million participants every week ran the Gospel Project. So that was phenomenal, just as an experience to be able to work with that team, to learn leadership. Like the leadership was weird because there were all these dots connected, you know, where I'm having to lead laterally. Teams that are like not like reporting to me, but like in when it came to the content, they were, but not like as employees. So it was just this sprawling structure at Lifeway and having to figure out how to lead with influence, not with positional authority, but then at times having to put a foot down and say, no, we're not going to say that this way, because, you know, we really wanted to push against the sort of moralistic kids curriculum that is so prevalent.
Yeah.
So the Gospel Project, the second part of my tenure at Lifeway was also great. Part of it was I was a teaching pastor at my church, preaching 40 weeks a year, which was really tiring, but great. So I had that like that church ministry going. But the second part of the time was helping launch the Christian Standard Bible. So I was put I moved into the role of the director of Bible and Reference, the Bibles team at Lifeway, at Holman Bible Publishers. Right as like just maybe 8-9 months before we launched the CSB. And I came to really love that translation and have enjoyed watching, you know, the different resources and the beautiful Bibles and just everything. If you're a nerd who loves Bibles and loves commentaries, being the Bible publisher is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So got to do that. And then towards the end of my tenure at Lifeway was the vice president for communications and theology and communications, which meant I got to oversee Lifeway Research, which is a respected research arm that does a lot of really good studies on different things, what's happening in the church, in culture, all kinds of things. Got to work with the leadership team there, the communications team there. And so just really, really a wonderful 11 years of learning with some leaders. That I was always the youngest guy at the leadership table. And it just, there were times I'd have to pinch myself and be like, how am I in this room? You know, like learning with these, because I mean, just some just fantastic leaders with great skill, great passion for the Lord, love for the church. That decade was extraordinarily formative for me.
Of the books you've written, what's your favorite one?
I think it would have to be The Thrill of Orthodoxy. I think I worked the hardest and longest on that one. The thing if you're writing a book called The Thrill of Orthodoxy,
it's got to be thrilling.
You got to work hard to make it interesting. You know, like you got to really, like I didn't want any reader to go a full 2-page spread without highlighting something, some sentence that would just, you know, jump out at you. And so I worked really hard on that one. And I, looking back at the different books that I've had the privilege of publishing and writing, I still think Thrill of Orthodoxy is like, it's a life one for me. Like I almost wrote it. Part of my thinking in writing it was, you know, when I'm 60, if the Lord gives me that many years, or 70, like I want to be held to this book.
Yeah.
I don't want to drift.
Yeah.
I want to be robustly evangelical, robustly open-handed, robustly Orthodox in my, like with a, you know, soft exterior maybe, but a backbone and spine that is, you know, of steel.
Yeah.
And I think Thrill of Orthodoxy is, I wanted readers to also want that.
Yeah.
And to see that as beautiful and good.
You and I have had the joy of collaborating together and getting to know each other better through the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics. How would you describe what the Keller Center is? Because when people ask me that, I'm sort of like, it's kind of like a think tanky thing where we serve one another by learning together. But people always want to know, like, what's the secret sauce to the Keller Center? How do you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, I basically just say it's a collection of people, at least originally. I mean, people that Keller himself signed off on, you know, right before he died, really. But it was people that he in some way recognized are tracking with his overall vision for what I think he would say is you need the combination of doctrine, personal piety, and cultural engagement. And some people are really strong on one of those three. Few are strong in all three of those things. I think what's beautiful about the Keller Center is it's a bunch of people who are at least aspiring to that kind of, you know, holding together things that tend to get separated in evangelical life, doctrine, piety. And I say piety, I mean, in the good sense of like, you know, godliness, spirituality, yeah. Like, you know, knowing God. And cultural engagement, those things get split apart. And I think Keller at his best held those together pretty strong. Not all of his followers always do. And so I think at our best, the fellows sharpen each other. We don't always agree on everything. We've had some pretty good, robust debates on different things. We have different instincts because we come from different places and contexts.
Yeah.
You know, someone who's serving in Boston is going to have a bit of a different view than someone who's serving in California versus someone who's serving like you and here in Omaha, or someone in the UK,
yeah,
someone preaching in London, someone in Australia. I mean, it's just the wildly different contexts. All secular, secularizing and Western in some way, but still very, very different. It leads to really good conversation, sharpening. And there's been good collaboration too and partnerships. I mean, I've really gotten to know, especially some of the ones that are local in Nashville. There's a bunch of us in Nashville now. I've really gotten to know some brothers I knew okay, but not as well before. And it's I don't know about what you'd say. I think it's been one of the more life-giving things I've been a part of in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I was going to say my favorite thing is it's a safe place to have debates and discussions that what I like about the things that we talk about or think through together. So I would call it a thinking through kind of ethos, right? Where it's like, we're trying to work on a problem or work on a question or think through an issue. and there might be varied perspectives, and there might be interesting and strong sort of disagreement or debate. And then I like that it kind of like those conversations end up spilling over into like dinner time, where it's like I'll be sitting down for dinner and just like continuing to hash through something with a fellow as I'm really activated by like, man, I'm really thinking more deeply about this, and I haven't sorted through this question that I have yet, or I want to hear more about what you meant by that. So it's very life-giving to me just on the thought work side of things, which is something that I don't get to stretch those muscles quite as often in my work every day as a pastor. And so it's fun to have an outlet for that myself.
I always like to tell the story of like the first time all the Keller Center fellows met in New York. They did a kind of a scavenger hunt thing where like we were all going to different places and trying to take pictures together. And at some point, Christopher Watkin and Gavin Ortland and I wound up in a conversation that went into like on like the, you know, the legitimacy or the differences of opinion between Catholics and Protestants on birth control and why and how. And I don't even remember, but at some point we looked up, we smiled for the picture and we left. And I was like, wait, were we just in Grand Central Station? I completely had lost.
Where are we?
I didn't even know. Like, we're in these like amazing New York spots. And I'm looking back at the pictures like, oh, wait. Oh, we were there, but I was so engrossed in conversation with Chris and Gavin that I didn't even like register that we're actually taking a picture at like this famous place that people go. It was just, you know, part of the fun of it has been that.
So one of the joys we get is to sort of think about the interaction of church and culture and Christianity and culture. And one of the reasons I asked you to come here to Omaha is to serve us in our local Gospel Coalition chapter meeting. Just talking about some of those, what are some of the challenges for the church in sort of this modern post-Christian moment? And so I wanted to see if you would just tee up real quickly for our listeners, the stuff that you're talking about with the TGC gathering, just sort of the essence of what are the three or four challenges for the church in the moment that we're living in?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that. It's also one of the things that I love most about my current role at North American Mission Board, because in overseeing the resources and marketing team, I get to have a front row seat at all these church planters. We help churches plant churches, and usually more than 700 a year. And so I get to see what God is doing on the front lines of ministry. I just again and again, and in those conversations with church planters in a variety of different places, the North American Mission Board, it's been a great opportunity to stay connected to what is happening across the culture. So I take some of that, and then I'm able to, you know, take some through conversation, reading, conversation with Keller Center fellows, others, to try to distill for pastors some aspects of our cultural context that are going to help them be on mission. One of those is the big one that I go back to again. I wrote a little book about it, but I didn't use the term expressive individualism, but Rethink Yourself, the book, is basically about expressive individualism. It's the idea that when it comes to the purpose of life, you look in first to determine that yourself. Like in terms of priority, you look in first to discover who you are, define who you are by your deepest desires. Then you look around to other people for affirmation of that. And then if you want some kind of spiritual transcendence in your life, you can then look up to God or some higher power to, you know, affirm that kind of whatever you have decided. But in the essence, you look in first. That is in contrast to most traditional societies that in terms of priority, you look around first and the community tells you who you are. And then they look up to some kind of, you know, sacred order of things, ancestors or whatever it might be, that it explains why the world is the way it is. And then you look in. Mm. But if you pay careful attention to Jesus, he really pushes against both of those ways of life. He says some things that are shocking in the way they relativize the family. If you're going to have to listen to his word, if you want to be his mother, father, sister, brother, if you come after him, you have to hate your father, you know, even the let the dead bury their own dead it's shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking for the first century. But then Jesus also, so he basically says, nope, not community first, but he also says not yourself first. I mean, if you're going to follow him, to deny yourself, pick up your cross and follow him, whoever would find himself must lose himself. Right. So Jesus basically gives us that God-centered, and you know, you always hear it said, you know, God first, others second, me third. That's basically right. That's what the Bible teaches. But we actually find our fullest happiness when that's the way, when we look up to God, to his design for who we are, who we're supposed to be, we look around to the church that calls us to, you know, to who we are in our baptism and in our faith. And then we bring our unique, beautiful individuality to the church as part of our giftedness. So there's some other ones we could look at as well. Also the rise of different pseudo religions, pseudo spiritualities.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit? Cause yeah. I think that's an interesting concept.
Yeah. I the way I look at it is, I mean, you and I were having a conversation earlier. I'm still wrestling with how much of this is something to be celebrated and how much of it is like, well, maybe two cheers for that instead of three, you know, I don't know. I'm still working it out, but, we live in a world that is secularizing, right? And I think the idea is, well, fewer and fewer people are going to be spiritual or religious as time goes on, because more and more people are going to be naturalist, materialist, and basically secular in their sense of, you know, this world is all there is. Even if they may believe in a God, they're going to act as if he's not really relevant. I think that for the most part, that secularizing trajectory, it's kind of like it's kind of like a sidewalk pavement or something. And what you're seeing with these pseudo spiritualities is you're seeing cracks in the sidewalk everywhere and you're seeing grass coming through. Mm. Some of that grass is weeds. Some of it's grass, but it's peeking through the sidewalk of secularism. And so the two cheers part of me on that wants to celebrate that, to say, hey, you know, you can't banish the desire in the human heart, the God-shaped vacuum, the God-shaped hole, the desire for something beyond this world, the desire for a purpose that comes from outside of ourselves, not from inside of ourselves, you know, the thirst for the transcendent, the resonance that, you know, the German philosopher Hartmut Rosa would say comes from the uncontrollability of the world, right? That you find your deepest resonance in something that you don't master, but something that is there, that must be encountered, must be taken in. So I want a couple of cheers for that. And you can see it in multiple things. Like, you know, you can see it in like the gospel of wellness. Mm. When it comes to like just think about all the potions, lotions, you know, that the fitness culture around workout yeah. culture and stuff like that. I mean, or, you know, supplements, everything, you know, but you pay attention to the language around this stuff. It's all about toxins.
Yes.
Energies.
Yes.
You know, it's like, it's basically like, hey, to be your best self, you know, the world is bad and is, you know, there's even a bit of like, you know, Maha is like a little bit like yeah. make America healthy again. Not that some of that's not, you know, good for that. We want to be healthy, but it's just sort of this, I need to optimize
yeah.
Myself. So I think that's one. There's a neo-stoicism that is on the rise. And for listeners who may not be familiar with that stoicism term, it's like, you see this in like some of the workout culture, or in like, Ryan Holiday has done some popularizing of like Marcus Aurelius and whatnot. There's some stoic elements in the Apostle Paul. So there's elements of this that line up with a Christian vision of how do you make your way through, you know, make your way through a world of suffering in a way to where you can be unperturbed in the sense of I can collect myself and I have agency in the world and I can choose how I'm going to interact with others. You see this in the Jordan Peterson phenomenon to some extent. Some of the stuff in his book, 12 Rules for Life, basically like a dad talking yeah. to their son, like, make yeah. your bed, you know, yeah. stand up straight, shoulders, you know, which speaks to the fatherlessness of our culture. But, yeah, but I think that's one. I think gospel of artistic experience is another. One of the biggest ones is social justice.
Yeah.
And even some non-Christian observers have noticed that functions as a religion for some. We have to be careful with that, because, you know, Basil the Great wrote on social justice 1600 years ago. So at some point I want to say that's our word.
Yeah. Like,
you got that from us. But there's a particular sort of Marxist deformation of social justice that is prevalent in our society. And it divides everyone up into oppressor versus oppressed, but it has its own eschatology. It's got its own liberation narrative. It's got it like mimics the Christian story at a number of places. But it has a very reductionist, simplistic view of human nature and of the pervasiveness of sin. In some ways, it can lead to a corrective of maybe perhaps too individualistic understandings of the effects of sin. But in other ways, it's not pervasive enough because it doesn't recognize the line of sin going through, you know, the line of good and evil running through every human heart, as Solzhenitsyn would have said. So, yeah, we could point to a bunch of others, but these are like popping up all over the place.
Okay. And so the pseudo-spiritualities, is there anything else that's sort of like particularly compelling to you as you think about helping churches and church planters engage as missionaries in the modern world? Or are those the sort of most prevalent things that you sort of want to put on people's radars for them?
Yeah, I think for me, it's like, look for the opportunities where people are hungry, right? Yeah. Like if they're going to something, whether it's wellness or stoicism or social justice, whatever, there's an opportunity there, yeah. You know? And the gospel actually, the gospel will confront some of those areas in different places, in different ways, but also fulfills the deeper longing that leads people to go for those pseudo spiritualities anyway. So I think there's real opportunity for us in having a missionary encounter with people. And the other thing I would just say, like church, thinking about church members, some of this stuff, you're going to wind up lining up with people for very different motivations doing the same kinds of activities.
Yeah.
Like you may have like a, almost like a gospel of wellness guy that's doing CrossFit for whatever reason, that's different than you're going there and you're also working out or you're going to the gym or whatever. There's a connection point there, but you're there for, it's different to be there for, I want to better myself, be the best possible version of myself so I can live as long as humanly possible or, you know, look good for other people versus, you know, I want to steward my body well so that I, you know, love, you know, I take good care of my body. I glorify God with my body. I glorify, you know, God with how I live in the world, how I make my way in the world. Those are two radically different motivations, but the behaviors might be somewhat similar at times. So you have these connection points. And there may be some social justice causes where Christians are going to be allied with people who are not believers, but for very different motivations. We've talked about this with the pro-life movement for decades. Got feminists for life, atheists for life, you know. So all that to say is there's you're going to have these overlapping opportunities. Don't look at them as, you know, problems to overcome or like with a sort of tisk-tisk, you know, with your, you know, pointing your finger at people as like, oh, that's a pseudo-spirituality. I think we can understand that that's a spiritual hunger that's probably not leading to the Jesus as the fountain of living water, but we want to recognize that thirst and then answer it, right? You don't condemn people for being thirsty, for being hungry. And we have the bread of life and the fountain of living water that's what we want to offer. So I just encourage people that are listening to keep an eye out for those and to see how we can, you know, be better missionaries in the context God puts us in.
All right. Last question. And then we'll, go to another episode. So this is a teaser to you listeners. There's going to be another episode with Trevin. We're going to talk about one of his very current projects that he's working on. But I would just be interested to know, to close this podcast, Trevin, what's the next project you're thinking about that you can talk about? So like, is there something that you're interested in thinking about, writing about, working on, that's like kind of conceptual right now that you can talk about?
So two things I'm working on. One is I'm working on a daily liturgy.
We love that here.
Yes, I know. I'm thinking of something. I've been doing these prayer guides called Psalms in 30 Days, Life of Jesus in 30 Days, Letters of Paul in 30 Days, and it's basically three times a day prayer. It's like a daily office that you work through these significant portions of Scripture in a month's time, and people have really liked those, and I've really benefited from them, which is why I was glad to share them with others. But I've had people asking, you know, hey, could you do that? Could you do it for a whole year, but once a day and see what it looks like? And so that's currently what I'm working on. And hopefully by the end of next year, that will be out. The other thing that I'm thinking about, and it's kind of still, you know, crystallizing in my head. I was just on the plane thinking about this. I've got a couple of sermons recently where the Lord has like led me to different questions that Jesus asks in the Gospels. And I've thought about maybe taking six or seven of those questions and really doing something that's sort of semi-evangelistic, but also discipling with, it's a short resource, but that actually takes a closer look at some of those questions. What are you seeking? Do you want to be healed? What do you want me to do for you?
Yeah. I just preached on that one recently.
Which one?
What do you want me to do for you?
Yeah. Oh, wasn't it great?
Yeah.
Okay, did you, I mean, cause it happens with the disciples, the two disciples, and then the two blind men.
Yeah.
Like in the same passage, Jesus asks the same question. It's amazing. It's so great. Yeah. So, you know, do you love me? I don't know. I think finding the right, you know, what the crucial questions Jesus asks of us. And then the most important one, who do you say that I am?
Yeah.
So
that's fascinating. Thanks for coming to Omaha, Nebraska. You said this is your first time in Nebraska.
It is.
So we're glad to have you here. Thanks for taking the time to talk on the podcast. And I hope to read your 40th book like 20 years from now. So I'm looking forward to whatever that 40th book is.
I hope to write it 20 years from now.
Looking forward to that. Well, the goal of this podcast, as we always say, is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, like Trevin is, thanks for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We always love to hear what topics you would like us to talk about or questions that you want us to address. So if you have feedback or topic ideas, reach out, podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.